content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic, Virtuoso Travelers Boundless, and AAA Go Magazine. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we are going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we join writer and photographer Evgenia Arbogueva for some Arctic dreaming. Now, her article is found in the December 2020 issue of National Geographic. She tells the story of a Soviet-era effort to develop the Arctic, starting with a small community called Dykeson. As the editors note, lives and legend are frozen in time during the long polar night of Russia's far north. People say that once you have the Arctic in your system, it will always be calling you. I spent my childhood running about the tundra and watching the northern lights as I walked to school in the polar night, the poetic name for the 2 months of darkness that not just winter here, but also a state of mind. I left my hometown of Dixie, a remote seaport on the shore of Russia's Laptev Sea, years ago to live in big cities in different countries. But the Arctic has been calling me back. I crave its isolation and slower pace of life. In this frozen northern landscape, my imagination flies like the wind with no obstacles. Every object becomes symbolic, every shade of color meaningful. I am my real self only when I am here. It's much the same for those I photograph. Sometimes I think their stories are like chapters in a book, each revealing a different dream, but each also connected to a love of this land. There's the hermit who imagines he's living on a vessel at sea, and the young woman who dreamed of living with her beloved at the edge of the world. Then there's the community that's keeping its past and future alive as its members follow the traditions and retell the myths of their ancestors. And finally, there's the old Soviet dream of polar exploration and conquest. Each dream has its own color palette and atmosphere. Each person who is here for a reason. The first dream belongs to Vyacheslav Kuraki. He was the longtime chief of the Kodovarika meteorological station on an isolated peninsula on the Barents Sea, a slender Barents spit of land that Kuraki says feels like a ship. When I first met him, I instantly recognized his tarpaulin jacket, the kind all men wore back in Soviet times in my hometown. He is what is known as a polarnik, a specialist of the polar north, and has dedicated his life to work in the Arctic. He still helps report on weather. Outside the station, I could hear ice shifting and grinding, and the wind making the radio wires whistle. Inside, it was quiet, with only Karaki's footsteps and squeaking door marking the passage of time. Every 3 hours, he'd leave, then return, muttering observations to himself. Wind, south, southwest, 12 meters per second, gust up to 18 meters, getting stronger, pressure falls, snowstorm is coming. Which he would then report over a crackling old radio to a person he has never seen. One day, I felt sad, the polar night causing my thoughts to run in chaotic directions. I came to Kuraki with a cup of tea and asked how he could live here alone every day the same. He told me, "You have too many expectations, and I guess it's normal. But every day is not the same here. Look, today you saw the bright aurora borealis and a very rare phenomenon of thin ice covering the sea. Wasn't it great to see the stars tonight after they were hiding from us behind the clouds for over a week? I felt guilty for gazing too much inside of myself, forgetting to observe outside. From then on, I became all eyes. 1 month, I lived with a young couple, Evgenia Kostakova and Ivan Sivkov, who were collecting meteorological data at another frozen edge of Russia. Kostakova had asked her beloved Sivkov to join her up north after their first year together in a Siberian city. They monitored the weather, chopped wood, cooked, tended the lighthouse, and looked after each other. For medical help, they relied only on a distant helicopter, but it could be delayed for weeks in rough weather. Kostakova called her mother almost every day, but as there was little news to report, she'd often ask her mother to leave the phone on speaker and to go about her housework. Kostakova would just sit and listen to the sounds of her faraway home. Perhaps partly because of their isolation, the 300 Chechi in the village of Inuimino have kept their traditions. Living off the land and sea as their ancestors did, hewing to the same myths and legends passed through the generations. It is an honor to be a hunter, and the villagers follow federal and international quotas as they hunt for walrus and whale to sustain their community through the long winters. Not far from Inuimino, I spent about 2 weeks in a wooden hut with a scientist who was studying walruses. We were trapped inside for 3 of those days, careful not to set off a panic among the estimated 100,000 walruses that had hauled out around us, their movements and fighting shaking our hut. The dream of Soviet greatness is covered in frost in Dykeson, on the shore of the Kara Sea. During its heyday in the 1980s, it was called the capital of the Russian Arctic, but since the demise of the USSR, it has become almost a ghost town. Perhaps there will be new towns as the region warms, but it pains me to see the failure of human effort on such a scale. During my first weeks, I was disappointed with the photos I shot in Dykeson's endless darkness, but then the aurora borealis suddenly exploded in the sky, coloring everything in neon hues for several hours. Cast in green light, a monument to soldiers looked like the Frankenstein's monster, who, after all, at the end of Mary Shelley's book, escaped to the isolation of the Arctic. Then the aurora faded, and the town started to slowly disappear back into darkness, until finally it was invisible. Now, to give you a better picture of Russia's Dykeson region, consider this. Less than 2% of Russia's population live in the 1.6 million square miles north of the Arctic Circle, according to the editors. Well, next, we're going to continue Evgenia Arbogaeva's story by sharing some captions from the photographs that she took and that accompany her article. Garaki walks toward a lighthouse in this photograph of a lighthouse out amidst just a plain of snow. It went out of service over 10 years ago, she writes. When he ran short of firewood, he'd pry away at the lighthouse timber panels to heat the weather station where he lived and worked. That station has since been replaced with a newer facility. And then we have a shot of an old radio. The radio at this old weather station transmitted meteorological data such as temperature and precipitation to the station in the closest city. Arkhangelsk, nearly 500 miles away, Karaki continues to report meteorological data every 3 hours, night and day. A lighthouse model that Karaki is building from matches seems to cast a shadow of the Arctic landscape against the wall of the weather station. The little lighthouse rests atop a Soviet reference book. It's called The Dynamics of Sea Ice. And it's quite an interesting little replica that looks almost like an exact scale model of the real thing. And then in our final picture on this page, we have a gentleman looking up at a parrot in a cage. Kisha, the parrot, a New Year's gift from photographer Evgenia Arbogaeva, keeps Garaki company as he eats lunch at the old weather station. Kisha is named after a bird in a popular Soviet-era cartoon. The next photograph is actually a two-pager, and this is titled, I Brought Treats Like Chocolate and Fruit, and Arbogaeva says, these little things are like gold in the Arctic, and brought the biggest smile to meteorologist and lighthouse keeper Evgenia Kostakova's face. She wrapped the apples one by one in newspaper as if they were made of crystal to prevent them from freezing, and that's what she's got a picture showing how they do that, and along with a glass that's filled with forks. Then we go to some more photographs on the next page, and we start with the edge of the world. That's what a meteorologist and lighthouse keeper Ivan Sikoff wrote in white paint on this storage shack, and that's all it is. It's in acrylic or Russian, and this little shack is covered with snow. Now, underneath the eave, the boards are wide open. There's no snow built up there, but all around is snow. The only thing that stands out in this picture is this little shack. Now, the shack sits near where an icebreaker docks to deliver supplies to the Canaan Numbers Lighthouse and the meteorological station, and it does this every summer. Now, here we have another shot, and they're actually on, it looks like an ice shelf, and there's water separating them and the next shelf. It's Kostakova and Sikoff joined by their dog Dragon. They collect water samples to measure the salinity of the seawater surrounding the narrow Canaan Peninsula, where the White Sea and the Barents Sea meet. And then we have the couple make their way toward the lighthouse, which seems to rise in the air in the midst of a blizzard. It is one of the few remaining lighthouses in the Arctic. And, I mean, it's impressive. You think it's nothing but just this white thing, this little light peering out near the top center of the photograph. You can barely make out the lighthouse itself and two little dots that are the figures that it's describing heading toward the lighthouse. And it says it's one of the few remaining lighthouses in the Arctic. New sea routes are opening, and many ships today have modern navigation systems, which obviously means they no longer require the lighthouse. And then on the last picture, we see a picture of Kostakova. She sits in a chair near a window and has a little electric heater plugged up near her feet. She keeps warm by a small radiator, and she reads her book. And when Kostakova was a little girl, a family friend told her stories of Arctic life. At 19, she began work at her first polar station. She says she instantly knew that the Arctic was the right place for her. And then we have another two-pager, and this one entitled When We Were Surrounded by Walruses. It goes on, the hut was shaking, Arbogava says. The sound of their roaring was very loud. It was hard to sleep at night. The temperature in the hut was also raised dramatically because of the walrus body heat outside. At this massive Pacific walrus rookery, so many had hauled out to shore, about 100,000. Think of that for a minute. Because the warming climate meant less sea ice for them to rest on. And I have to say, I've seen walruses fairly up close in a couple of exhibitions. They are large mammals, so it's kind of interesting to think of 100,000 come together. And then we have another set of photographs. In this first one, we have Nikolai Rotin is lost in thought after speaking of his wife who passed away last year. He now lives alone in an abandoned weather station. Before the Soviets attempted to develop the Arctic, he lived in Yaranga, a traditional Chukchi home of wood and reindeer skin. So this poor fellow is definitely lost in thought, and not much room there in that abode, but it looks like he's got blankets, and it's been built to withstand the weather. And then in the next scene, we see a walrus skull rest on a table in a hunter's garage. Walrus meat is a primary means of sustenance for the Chukchi community, which, local hunters say, is allowed an annual quota of walruses and whales. Hunters use the traditional harpoons as well as modern guns. And then we move to another picture. Vika Tunum wears a customary Chukchi dress called the Kamlika as she rehearses a traditional dance in the cultural center in Inumino. Many dances mimic animal movements, and this one is meant to conjure birds such as geese, ducks, and seagulls. And this stage is very simple. It's got a floral pattern curtain all around it. I've never seen one. Most stages, if you go to, it's a solid color, but this one's got floral patterns. And then they have a kind of a beige, dark beige drop behind her, and she's definitely dressed for winter. And as she practices her dancing. And then in the final photo, this is kind of a poignant one. It says, night falls as Chukchi hunters head home after harpooning this gray whale for its meat. It's lying there on the shore. On the return voyage, by tradition, the hunters are silent, speaking only in their minds and only to the whale, asking forgiveness and explaining why the hunt was necessary. And then we have a picture of a piano on one side of a two-page photo. And the other side is a window that's, you can see the ice forming on the windows and the snow outside, and an old radiator that's got snow all over it, because it appears that window may be broken, and I think it is, so the air, Arctic air, is coming in. And this picture taken in Dykeson, it says, I imagine the music playing and the stars sparkling in unison after I first entered the quiet room, says Arbogava. But then I began to hear the wind slamming doors in the corridor and strange creaking sounds. In my fuzzy imagination, I thought I heard someone's footsteps, and I ran. Believe it or not, the piano, also covered with some snowflakes and ice, and the keys are still showing, and the keyboard is still in good shape. Now, whether you could play it or not is another question. I do not know. And then we have another set of photos taken in Dykeson, and we have the Aurora Borealis, or Northern Lights, casting colorful spell over a monument in this abandoned town square in Dykeson. The statue honors the soldiers who defended the once thriving outpost against the German attack during World War II. The children who last attended school here are now adults, but their textbooks still lie open, and that's what the next picture features. The textbook, along with some shoes, looks like sneakers, that are also captured in the photograph. Arbogava waited through 2 weeks of darkness and stormy weather until the Aurora Borealis provided enough light for photographs. Now, the cultural center, once alive with performances and celebrations, has long stood empty. Its Soviet architectural style can be found in other Arctic outposts developed during the push to build infrastructure along the Northern Sea shipping route. And it's kind of reminiscent of some of these old West towns you might see photographs of in the wild western parts of the United States, so, except you got snow, and then above it, the Aurora Borealis. A homemade doll in the final photograph leans against a frosty windowsill of an abandoned school in Dykeson. In its heyday in the 1980s, the town was a symbol of Arctic ambitions and home for a population of about 5,000. Imagine that. So 100,000 walruses and 5,000 people at one time in one place in the far north of Russia in the Arctic zone. Wow. Well, now that we've acclimated to the colder climate of the Arctic, let's enjoy some time in our northern neighbor of Canada. We're going to do this by reading from Boundless. This is a publication designed for travel professionals and seasoned globetrotters, and it's going to begin with the happy dance of the Aurora Borealis, which we've been featuring so far. It's written by Debbie Olson, and she shares her experience of seeing the northern lights in the Yukon of Canada. Outside our lodge, the world is dark and still. My husband and I gather with other guests around a large stone fireplace for an evening of storytelling with James Allen, the elder from the southern Tuchene First Nations. His people have lived in this corner of the Yukon since time immemorial, and he tells us the stories and legends he grew up with. The one I like best is about the Aurora Borealis, and I should have said Tuchene, not Tuchene. There are many legends about the Northern Lights, explains Allen. Our story is that the Northern Lights are a message from ancestors who have passed on. They dance in the spirit world to let us know they are happy there. The lure of these legendary lights is what brought my husband and me to the Yukon. In the winter, it's a place of snow, ice, and extended lights. Clear, dark skies and a strategic location inside the auroral oval make the Yukon one of the best spots on the planet to see this breathtaking celestial display. Our lodge is located on the border of Kluane National Park and Reserve, a place with inky black skies untouched by artificial light. Unfortunately, the night is cloudy and not ideal for aurora watching. We retreat to our cabin and enjoy a deep sleep, undisturbed by any sound except the occasional hoot of an owl. We're up early the next day to meet Allen once more, this time for a special indigenous cultural tour. My husband and I take turns driving a snowmobile as we follow Allen along his trap line. He shows us a variety of handmade traps and talks about his memories going out into the land trapping, foraging, and fishing with his grandfather. Afterward, we follow him to a lake where we try ice fishing. Hearing Allen's story stirs something inside me, especially the legend of the Aurora. I like the idea that the Aurora has a deeper meaning. I think about the people in my life who have passed on, and I hope they are happy. I hope they dance. On the last night of our trip, we join a local tour operator for an aurora viewing excursion. It's a new moon, and conditions are ideal for viewing this marvel of nature. We'll keep warm inside a heated yurt, and we wait. Just after midnight, the first burst of green light appear in the dark sky. It's as if someone has turned on spotlights. Before long, colorful ribbons of green and pink are moving and twirling between the stars. An hour later, dramatic dancing green and red waves of light are cascading from one side of the horizon to the other in a mesmerizing, ethereal show. It's extremely cold, but for a while we lie on the snow and gaze up at the sky. Then it occurs to me that I shouldn't let my ancestors dance alone. Under the blazing sky, I do a dance of my own to let them know I'm happy here. Well, as we explore parts of Canada, the editors of Boundless briefly spotlight a couple of travel adventures you could enjoy. if you thought about doing that kind of trip. The first segment, called Adventure by Air, and it writes, get ready to be whisked away by private helicopter to a frozen place, and there's a picture of three people headed toward a helicopter on a snowplane, gliding high above Whistler in the Fitzsimmons Range in British Columbia. You'll discover the hidden depths of Garibaldi Provincial Park. And that's before the tour really gets going. Once you land, you'll spend the day exploring volcanic peaks, glittering ice fields, and caverns by snowmobile. To cap off this amazing experience, you'll be guided to a crystalline cavern with a soaring aqua blue ceilings of gleaming ice. Here, your table is set for the most memorable champagne service in the world. After all, a discovery this grand calls for bubbles. And you can discover Canada's southernmost ice fields, as they show in this picture, and then touch down and explore ancient ice caps on a fully guided tour. And then the next one is a family getaway in the Laurentian Mountains. Just outside of Montreal, there's a skier's paradise nestled within one of the oldest mountain ranges in the world. In fact, picturesque Mont Tremblant has the largest, most varied skiable terrain in eastern North America. Once you and your family have exhausted yourselves on the slopes, take a ride through the quaint villages that dot the landscape and discover fondue made from local cheeses, or enjoy an evening of fine dining and wine pairing. Between the warm welcomes and local delicacies, you'll find no shortage of après delights. And it says Mont Tremblant has more than 100 ski trails spread across 755 acres of diverse terrain. It's ideal for skiers and snowboarders at all levels. Well, we're going to next step into the wild as writer Heather Greenwood Davis leads us on a search for wildlife in Western Canada, and she's going to help us find bears and build some memories. The eco-friendly jet boat we're riding in bumps and glides along the Blue River as we head away from the dock. The beginnings of the bright blue skies that will permeate the afternoon here in British Columbia's North Thompson Valley are glimpsed through white clouds stretched to whiffs above us, and the fog drifting from the surface of the water looks like steam. It's early, but I'm already grateful for the baseball cap that keeps me from squinting. My family has come to British Columbia with bears on our minds. Grizzlies, to be precise. We are city slickers, and raccoons are the biggest critters we have encountered. The idea that people in this province might pass a bear on their morning walk has been enough to keep my tween boys scanning the shoreline. They're hanging on to every word, our guide says, and grow quiet each time he raises his binoculars. And just as a point of fact, one quarter of the North American grizzly bear population is found in British Columbia. For the most part, the 15,000 grizzly bears that call British Columbia home mind their own business. They're large and lumbering, but also incredibly quiet. So exploring with a tour operator is your best way to see them. Plus, these bears aren't here for us. They are wild, and when or if we see them is completely up to them. They're out there, and they're probably seeing us long before we're seeing them, our guide cautions. It's one of the many times on this outing that my husband, sons, and I will lock eyes, raise eyebrows, and rub away the goosebumps on our arms. British Columbia is home to some of the most beautiful landscapes in the world. In a province where snow-capped mountains meet pristine parklands and old-growth forest end at a rocky shoreline, there are plenty of pretty views to pass the time. Suddenly, the sound of something slapping the water catches our attention. Bear! My son Cameron says, eyes wide and finger pointing. And he's right. A brown bear fishing for salmon offers us our first heart-pounding moment. We sit silently watching until it ambles off into the woods, and then we burst from excitement. That was amazing, my son Ethan says. It felt so close. After lunch, we hop into an all-terrain vehicle for a different vantage point. Our guide points out the telltale footprints on the forest floor and reaches into berry bushes for samples the grizzlies have overlooked. Eagles, osprey, and waterfalls have us snapping photos at every turn. We spot more bears, too, and despite the safe distance, each sighting is a thrill. As a parent, watching and listening to my kids ask questions, when will they hibernate, are there any babies, brings me joy. Family time can feel so fleeting, and sharing an activity that combines the adrenaline rush kids love with the educational components parents crave has made for a picture-perfect trip. Just when we think the bears moved on, the jeep stops abruptly, and our guide raises a finger to his lips. Mere steps from our vehicle, a mama grizzly pokes her head out from the bushes, sizes us up, and then stands guard as her cubs scamper to the other side. I snuggle closer to my own cubs in the Jeep, comfortably connected to the ways of the wild. Wow, what an experience, huh? A couple of great photos here. The commode, which is a term that means spirit, but it's also a rare subspecies of the American black bear. Its white or cream-colored coat is the result of a recessive gene. And spirit bears are found only in the Great Bear Rainforest, and that's a 15.8 million-acre ecosystem on British Columbia's north and central coast. So quite the undertaking there, huh? Well, we'll share more articles from Boundless for winter and spring 2021 in future episodes. We're going to wind up today with some excerpts from Nine Reasons to Road Trip to Rouen by Virginia Brown. It appears in the November-December 2020 issue of AAA Go magazine. Just northeast of Charlotte, downtown or down home Rouen County offers travelers a wide range of things to do. While the area celebrates its history, it's also in tune with the present. Museums, gold mines, an exotic animal drive-through, walking trails and wineries, plus loads of little shops make Rouen County worth a look. And we start with Cheers. Like its sister counties in the Piedmont of North Carolina, Rouen offers many wineries and breweries for a day of relaxation. Cobble Creek Vineyard, the state's 100th winery, specializes in sweet North Carolina-grown muscadine wines, while Douglas Vineyards, also known for its sweet fruit vines, boasts great ports. Morgan Ridge Vineyards in Gold Hill offers estate wines and craft brews with expansive grounds, plus in downtown Salisbury, the Morgan Ridge Railway Brewery and Eatery, named for the original name, Old Sarum, of Salisbury's namesake, and sister city in England. New Sarum Brewing's Cheerwine Brew was so popular it sold out quickly after just two releases. Go for the gold. Rouen County has a deep history in gold mining. In its southeastern corner is Gold Hill Mines and Historic Park. Here you'll find one of the most significant facilities for the mining or panning or mining of gold, I should say, and copper in North Carolina. Gold wasn't first discovered here, rather on the Reed family farm in nearby Cabarrus County. However, gold production was strong in the region from the 1820s to about 1915. The whole historic Gold Hill complex offers festivals and events like guided ghost tours in the fall, plus Morgan Ridge Winery, and a lot more. Soak up the cute atmosphere while visiting antique shops, art studios, and more. Mama T's restaurant has two nice porches for dining and offers live musical performances on select evenings. Enjoy juicy sirloin steaks, spaghetti and homemade sauce, sandwiches, and more. Save room for dessert because Mama T's are divine. And then All Aboard, a North Carolina transportation museum located on the one-time site of the Southern Railway Company's largest steam locomotive repair facility in Rouen. The museum will leave the little ones and adults alike wide-eyed with its authentic train depot, antique cars, and the kicker, a 37-bay roundhouse with 25 locomotives, rail cars, and other transportation-themed exhibits. So there's lots to do there in Rouen County. There's also canopy camping, some exotic animals, and farm fun and shopping spots. So keep that all in mind. That's it for today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be around to join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.